Hello, everybody. This is Margaret Harris in Geneva, welcoming you today, Thursday, October 10, to this week's WHO Global Press Briefing on COVID-19, focusing today on the strategy needed to vaccinate the world against this disease. This is a very special event, as we have with us today Mr. Antonio Guterres, the United Nations Secretary General, who will, with our WHO Director General, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, outline what we need to do to get the world vaccinated against COVID-19 by the middle of 2022. This is a big moment, and this is a big topic. So I will ask you all to keep your questions to COVID-19, focusing on these really important issues we need to discuss today. We also have in the room and online our usual experts, Dr. Mike Ryan, Executive Director, World Health Emergencies Program, Dr. Maria Van Kerkhove, Technical Lead for COVID-19, Dr. Bruce Aylward, who is the lead for the ACT Accelerator, Dr. Kate O'Brien, Director of Immunization Vaccines and Biologicals, and Ms. Tanya Chinesky, who is the technical lead for the vaccine strategy. And Dr. Soumya Swaminathan will be joining as well. As usual, our interpreters will be providing simultaneous interpretation in the 6 official UN languages, plus Hindi and Portuguese, and I thank you all in advance for that. Now, without further ado, I will hand over to Dr. Tedros for his opening remarks. Dr. Tedros, you have the floor.
Thank you. Thank you, Margarita. Dear Secretary General, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. At this press conference, almost exactly 1 year ago, I said that the world was eagerly anticipating the results of trials of vaccines against COVID-19. And I also said that once we had a vaccine, we must use it effectively by making sure it's available to all countries equitably. The development and approval of vaccines in record time took us to the summit of scientific achievement. Now we stand on the precipice of failure if we don't make the benefits of science available to all people in all countries right now. More than 6.4 billion vaccine doses have now been administered globally, and almost one-third of the world's population is fully vaccinated against COVID-19. But those numbers mask a horrifying inequity. High and upper middle income countries have used 75% of all vaccines produced so far. Low income countries have received less than half of 1% of the world's vaccines. In Africa, less than 5% of people are fully vaccinated. As you know, earlier this year, WHO set a target for all countries to vaccinate 10% of their populations by the end of September. 56 countries didn't make it through no fault of their own. Today, WHO is launching the strategy to achieve global COVID-19 vaccination by mid-2022. The strategy outlines the road we must all take together to achieve our targets of vaccinating 40% of the population of every country by the end of this year, and 70% by the middle of next year. Achieving these targets will require at least 11 billion vaccine doses. This is not a supply problem. It is an allocation problem. By the end of September, almost 6.5 billion doses had already been administered worldwide. With global vaccine production now at nearly 1.5 billion doses per month, there is enough supply to achieve our targets, provided they're distributed equitably. Contracts are in place for the remaining 5 billion doses, but it's critical that those doses go where they are needed most, with priority given to older people, health workers, and other at-risk groups. We can only achieve our targets if the countries and companies that control vaccine supply put contracts for COVAX and the African Vaccine Acquisition Trust, AVAT, first for deliveries and donated doses. We have the tools to bring the pandemic under control if we use them properly and share them fairly. And we must remember that vaccines are a powerful tool, but not the only one. All countries must continue with a comprehensive, risk-based approach of public health and social measures in combination with equitable vaccination. Vaccine equity will accelerate the end of the pandemic. Achieving WHO's vaccine equity targets will substantially increase population immunity globally, protect health systems, enable economies to fully restart, and reduce the risk of new variants emerging. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by the United Nations Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, who, like us, has long called for global vaccine equity. Secretary General, thank you for your support and advocacy throughout the pandemic and also your special focus on vaccine equity. Welcome, and you have the floor.
Thank you very much, dear Tedros. Ladies and gentlemen of the press, vaccine inequality is the best ally of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's allowing variants to develop and run wild, condemning the world to millions more deaths and prolonging an economic slowdown that could cost trillions of dollars. I've long been pushing for a global vaccination plan to reach everyone, everywhere, sooner rather than later. A plan that I suggested should be implemented by an emergency task force made up of present and potential vaccine production countries with World Health Organization, COVAX partners, and international financial institutions, working with the pharmaceutical companies to guarantee the production of enough doses and their equitable distribution. Unfortunately, I've not been heard. Yet instead of global coordinated action to get vaccine where they are needed most, we have seen vaccine hoarding, vaccine nationalism, and vaccine diplomacy. We, of course, welcome efforts by countries to get vaccines to more places, but a plethora of global, regional, and bilateral initiatives has failed to deliver. It has not got us anywhere close to the first benchmark of 10% vaccination in all countries by the end of September, as Dr. Tedros just said. And this even though the number of doses required comes to less than 1 week of global manufacturing output. That is why I'm very pleased to join Dr. Tedros today to launch the global COVID-19 vaccination strategy. This is a costed, coordinated, and credible pass out of COVID-19 pandemic for everyone, everywhere. This detailed plan of action drawn up by the World Health Organization is designed to get vaccines, as it was said, into the arms of 40% of people in all countries by the end of this year and 70% by the middle of 2022. And it is based on a thorough scientific analysis of the evolving pandemic, the effectiveness of vaccines, the cost of procuring and delivering them, and global demand and supply. Through those sharing, swaps, technological transfers, and other priority actions, it is possible to reduce deaths and minimize suffering, prevent health systems from being overwhelmed, resume social and economic activities, and reduce the risk of dangerous new variants. It is up to member states to do their part, to come together, doing everything that is needed for this strategy to succeed. And the entire United Nations system is mobilized around supporting governments to end this pandemic, from health and humanitarian workers to logistics and operational experts and communication specialists, through our verified campaign to fight the plague of vaccine misinformation. With vaccine production now at nearly 1.5 billion doses per month, we can reach 40% of people in all countries by year's end, if we can mobilize some $8 billion to ensure that distribution is equitable. Because crucially, the success of this plan requires equitable distribution. And without a coordinated, equitable approach, a reduction of cases in any one country will not be sustained over time. For everyone's sake, we must urgently bring all countries to a high level of vaccination coverage. G20 countries have frequently spoken of their desire to get the world vaccinated. Their meeting later this month will be an opportunity to deliver. I urge all global stakeholders to step up, mobilize their resources, and turn this strategy into a reality. And I wish WHO the best success in all the efforts WHO has been doing to make sure that we are able to defeat the COVID-19 pandemic. Thank you very much, Dr. Tedros. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen of the press.
Thank you so much, Secretary General. Thank you so much for your leadership. And as you said, this plan can only succeed with everyone's cooperation. We call on all countries to update their national COVID-19 vaccine targets and plans to guide manufacturing investment and vaccine distribution. We call on countries with high vaccine coverage to swap delivery schedules with COVAX and Abbott and to fulfill their dose-sharing pledge immediately. We call on vaccine-producing countries to allow free cross-border flow of finished vaccines and raw materials and to enable sharing of know-how, technology, and licenses. We call on vaccine manufacturers to prioritize and fulfill contracts with COVAX and Abbott as a matter of urgency, to be more transparent on what's going where, and to share know-how and non-exclusive licenses to enable all regions to increase manufacturing capacity. We call on civil society, community organizations, and the private sector to continue to advocate local, nationally, and globally for equitable access, not just to vaccines, but also to tests and treatments. We call on all countries to ensure they have the capacities in place to use all doses as rapidly and efficiently as possible. And we call on global and regional multilateral development banks to support countries to more rapidly access the capital they need to fund vaccine delivery programs. Finally, although equitable distribution of vaccines will help to end the pandemic, its effects will continue to be felt for many years, especially for the people who have been infected and will continue to suffer from the effects of post-COVID-19 condition, also known as long COVID. Yesterday, after a global consultation with patients and experts, WHO published a clinical case definition for post-COVID-19 condition. The definition says that post-COVID-19 condition usually occurs 3 months from the onset of COVID-19, with symptoms that last for at least 2 months and which cannot be explained by an alternative diagnosis. Some patients have reported symptoms of post-COVID-19 condition for much longer than 2 months. Common symptoms include fatigue, shortness of breath, cognitive dysfunction, and others that have an impact on everyday functioning. This standardized definition will help clinicians to identify patients more easily and provide them the appropriate care, and is crucial for advancing recognition and research. WHO encourages all national authorities, policymakers, and clinicians to adopt this definition. Margarita, back to you.
Thank you, Dr. Tedros and Mr. Secretary General. So now I'll open the floor for questions. And as I said, this is really about the strategy. This is about COVID. So I will ask you to confine your questions to those topics. And we're also, the Secretary General has got limited time, so we will send the questions to him first. We've already got some people who've indicated that they have questions for the Secretary General. And the first one is Sherwin Bryce Peace from the South African Broadcasting Corporation. Can you unmute yourself, Sherwin, and ask your question?
Thanks very much. Can you hear me?
Very well. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Dr. Tedros, Secretary General, in October 2020, the global death toll was around 1.3 million, the month at which South Africa and India presented their proposal for a TRIPS IP waiver at the World Trade Organization. A year later, that death toll is exceeding 5 million. Amnesty International says vaccine pharma companies are fueling an unprecedented human rights crisis through their refusal to waive intellectual property rights and share vaccine technology. At what point will officials like the Director General, like the Secretary General, be able to say pharmaceutical companies and countries blocking or stalling efforts towards a waiver are now directly responsible for continued deaths? Because there's a strong case to be made that it's no longer COVID-19 that's killing people, but a lack of access to these life-saving immunizations.
Well, this demonstrates that, unfortunately, fight COVID-19 pandemic, leadership and power are not aligned. WHO, the whole UN system have shown leadership, but we have no power. We have no power to determine the things that you have just mentioned. We have no power to force companies to license or to make countries accept that there is a the TRIPS will not apply. We cannot force countries to organize their vaccination programs in order to take into account also the vaccination programs of other countries. I mean, the power is in the countries that produce vaccines or might produce them and in the companies. And that is why I've been saying since the beginning that they need to come together and to make sure that there is a vaccination plan to everybody everywhere. In the absence of that effort by those that have power, WHO and UN, showing leadership, are presenting a strategy which would allow to vaccinate 40% of people everywhere until the end of this year, and 70% until June next year. Now, if those that were not able to come together to assume command with their power to make equitable distribution of vaccines, I hope that they will be able to come together to do the steps that are necessary for this strategy to be effectively implemented. And it is clear for me that this is a case in which the well-being of humankind and the dramatic situation of the global economy would require not business as usual, but exceptional rules, exceptional norms, and exceptional measures in order to be able to defeat the COVID. Each day the COVID goes on is people dying, and it is economies not being able to recover, and it's so a dramatic increase of suffering all over the world.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary General, and Dr. Tedros will add.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. I agree with what Secretary General said, and would like to add a bit. As you know, the TRIPS waiver was meant to be used during emergency situations like this one. And as also everybody knows, this pandemic is unprecedented. You can't just call it emergency. This is serious and unprecedented condition that happened of almost after 100 years, more than 100 years, of course, since the 1918 flu pandemic. So the question is, if we cannot use it now, during this unprecedented situation, when do we use the TRIPS waiver or the IP, the intellectual property waiver? You can even ask, why do we even in the first place have had this IP waiver in the provision if we're not going to use it in such conditions? I think manufacturers and governments should really ask themselves this question. As Secretary General said, we cannot force manufacturers and countries But, you know, we can challenge and pose these questions to check for themselves. In our discussions with the manufacturing industries and some governments who don't support the IP waiver, they tell us that even if IP is waived, it wouldn't help. And our response is, instead of saying it wouldn't help, then why don't you try it? Why do you protect it if it doesn't help? So let's waive it and try. And the excuse that comes with this is that it cannot work without technology transfer if even the IP is waived. But as you know, naturally, what happens is when IP is waived, since the knowledge is in the minds of people, those who know or have the knowledge could migrate to help others who can produce those vaccines. When it's legalized, people would be encouraged to migrate to apply the same thing in other places. Or, not full migration, but they can work part-time so they can support in as many places as possible, so the vaccine could be produced in as many places as possible, that increased production could bring equity. And everybody knows this. But those who know the technology would still stay with those who own the technology because it's illegal to go and work for others and transfer technology illegally. But I think going into details of this argument may not even help. The issue is the situation we're in is unprecedented, and this IP waiver is meant for such conditions, and we have to use everything at hand, all means at hand, to fight this pandemic. So still, the UN at large and WHO support all means, including IP waiver, to increase local production of vaccines so there is equitable distribution of vaccines. When we say this, it's not because we have problems with the private sector. We support private sector. We appreciate the private sector, actually, for developing these vaccines in a record time. And incentives should be given to the private sector. These incentives can be provided when IP waiver is done from governments. Governments who can provide incentives can provide incentives. But at the same time, the IP waiver could be for a limited period of time, not more than 2 to 3 years, and for select products, it could be vaccines and maybe specific to vaccines or maybe a couple of or three. In order to prevent, you know, any precedents that may affect the private for the long term, if that's the fear. The IP waiver could be controlled. So it's possible, and I fully agree with Secretary General, but we cannot force anyone. But we believe that governments and manufacturers have the obligation to really cooperate, because when they cooperate, it will help economically, the world will open up, and it will help us to end the pandemic, and it's morally also the right thing to do. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Tedros and Mr. Guterres. The next question is from Pamela Falk from CNBC. Pamela, please unmute yourself and ask your question.
I got it. Sorry, thank you. Dr. Harris, thank you very much for the questions. Pamela Falk from CBS News, based at the United Nations. My question is for the Secretary General. You said you want to mobilize $8 billion, and both you and Dr. Tedros say the rich countries and the private sector have not done enough. Now, many countries say they have given what they can, and COVAX has had quite a bit of success. The malaria vaccine, congratulations, moved forward with a lot of private foundation money and individuals. If you can't get these IP waivers or countries to give as much as you want, what is your fear for variants or the next major pandemic? What is your worst case scenario? Thank you so much.
Well, we need to avoid that worst case scenario. But one thing is clear. If we let the virus spread like wildfire in the global south, in the African continent and other parts of the global south, we know that variants will emerge. And we know that there is a risk that those variants might become resistant to vaccines, which means we have the risk if we let this lack of equity, if we leave it going on, and we allow for the virus to go on spreading like wildfire in the global south, there is a risk that one day, and that they can be very soon, there will be not the Delta, it will be another variant that will be able to resist vaccines. And all the vaccination effort made in developed countries to vaccinate the whole of their population, one, two or three times, all that effort will fall apart. And these people will not be protected. So not to have equitable distribution of vaccines is not only a question of being immoral. It is also a question of being stupid.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary General. And apologies to you, Pamela, for getting your outlet. That was Pamela from CBS. The next question we have is from Belisa Godinho from W Media Portugal. Belisa, please unmute yourself and ask your question. I believe it's for the Secretary General.
Thank you. I'm Belisa Godinho from W Magazine Media in Portugal, and I have a question for the Secretary General of the United Nations, António Guterres. I would like to know if, in his opinion, climate change could be related to the COVID pandemic, if for more effective fight against COVID at a global level, countries should not think about health in its connection with the environment and adopt more sustainable measures in parallel with administered vaccination. Thank you.
In relation to this communication, is it possible for our well, it is obvious that COVID is creating enormous difficulties in the economy and societies everywhere, and obviously those difficulties increasing the debt of countries, making countries unable to do the investments that are necessary. All these difficulties are undermining the capacity of developing countries to be able to respond to climate change, to make the investments necessary to reduce emissions and for adaptation and resilience of their societies. And so it's essential that developed countries implement the commitment made in order to provide $100 billion per year for developing countries, both for the reduction of emissions, but, and we ask for 50% of it to go, for the investments necessary to build resilience, for infrastructure, for communities, the so-called adaptation. So we need to make an additional effort in relation to support to developing states to fight climate change. We need an additional effort to compensate for the dramatic negative impact of COVID in their economies and their societies.
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary General. Now, I understand the Secretary General has very kindly given us more time than he had, and he will have to leave, but we will continue this press conference. The next journalist on the line is Majid Ghlai from Rudo Media Network Iraq. Majid, please unmute yourself and ask your question.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the opportunity. I would like to ask about the risk of lack of access, especially when it comes to the vaccine in conflict zones and refugee camps. As we all know, in most of those conflict zones in Syria and somewhere like in even Ethiopia, there is a problem with lack of medical access. Is there any special effort to make sure that refugees and people in a conflict zone get the adequate vaccine and not be deprived because of their situation? Thank you.
Thank you. Excellent question. We've got quite a few experts on that, and Dr. Bruce Aylward will lead with his answer.
Yeah, thank you very much for raising this, Majid. It's such a crucial issue. As the Director General and the Secretary General emphasize, we can't get out of this crisis unless we vaccinate and make available the tools to tackle COVID to populations everywhere. This includes, of course, as a global community, populations in fragile and conflict-affected settings in particular. So right from the very outset, when we first developed the planning tools, let's say, for the rollout of vaccination, the populations in these areas were given a special recognition. And in working with countries and groups that were working in such areas, we began right from the very beginning to make sure their national vaccine deployment plans accounted for and had special strategies for accessing populations in fragile, conflict-affected situations. And as you'll be aware, there's been a lot of experience in building access into such areas through campaigns like the polio eradication campaigns, measles campaigns, and others. So there's a wealth of knowledge, of experience, of partnerships that have been established to work with the communities and, in cases, governments, others as appropriate, to reach these areas. Now, sometimes many of those systems break down, and national plans don't always cover all of the population. Sometimes populations, refugee and other populations, can overwhelm a country's ability to help. So in that regard, the COVAX facility has put in place a special, what we call humanitarian buffer, which makes additional vaccine available for groups working in such areas to be able to ensure that there is a route to vaccines that can be accessed through the Interagency Standing Committee and other mechanisms to be able to ensure vaccines available for all populations. It's been a challenge. There are particular challenges to operating and vaccinating those areas, especially with vaccines that are under emergency use listing, but working with a number of donors, working with a number of manufacturers, we're slowly working our way through those challenges.
Dr. Ryan will add something.
Well, just a reminder to our member states that our member states remain primarily responsible for including refugees, migrants, and other vulnerable populations within their national plans for COVID-19 vaccination. The humanitarian buffer has specifically been put there to deal with those very specific situations in which governments may lack access to populations in certain parts of a given territory or where there are special circumstances. And we do thank those governments, and so many of you have done it, have included refugees, migrants, and other vulnerable populations within national plans, and many of you have put in place special arrangements for those populations to get access to vaccine. And we thank those of you who have done that, in addition to the millions of refugees who are hosted, and I might add, mainly in countries of the south, who have taken in millions and millions of refugees over the last number of years. The vast majority of refugees on this planet are being hosted in countries who can barely afford to support their own populations. And again, we thank those countries who are doing that. and we thank them once more for having made provision for refugees and migrants within their planning, and as I say, very much support Bruce's statement regarding the UN system, the IASC, and the special arrangements for the humanitarian buffer.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ryan and Dr. Aylward. The next question goes to Irene Hartman from Argentina, from Clarín newspaper, Argentina. Irene, please unmute yourself and ask your question.
Hello, did you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Thank you so much. I would like to ask you about Sputnik vaccine. In which status is actually the approval of this vaccine? In Argentina, we are very worried because 23% of the population is vaccinated with this vaccine, and it seems that we won't be able to travel freely to many countries. So it's very important to know, in which status is this approval, please. Thank you so much.
Dr. Mariangela Schimmel, who's Assistant Director General for Access to Medicines, will answer your question.
Thank you very much for the question, and I'm happy to do a quick update. The Gamaleya vaccine, which is the Sputnik V, has started the process with WHO earlier in the year, and the process was put on hold due to the lack of some legal procedures. And I'm happy to say that in discussions with the Russian government, in negotiations with the Russian government, this problem is about to be sorted out. As soon as the legal procedures are finished, we are able to restart the process. There are still the issues around complete information on the dossier that has to be provided by the applicant of by the Russian Direct Investment Fund. And there is also the issues regarding the finalization of the inspections in the different manufacturers in Russia. But I'm happy to say that the process is about to be restarted.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Aylward's got something to add.
Yeah, it's on the second part of what you mentioned, Eileen, and that was the importance of recognizing vaccines for international travel. And WHO is still deeply concerned that vaccines that have been proven efficacious, have been approved by WHO through the emergency use listing procedure that Mariangela just spoke to, are not being recognized in all countries. And again, we're calling on all countries to ensure the recognition of vaccines proven to be efficacious and safe, and certainly that meet WHO emergency use listing criteria.
Thank you so much, Dr. Aylward. Did you want to add something, Dr. O'Brien?
Just to add to what Bruce was commenting on, I think we have to recognize why it's a problem that those vaccines that are WHO emergency use listed are by some countries not being recognized. And the first is to say that, again, COVID vaccines are not a vaccine that is required under IHR for travel. So we want to reinforce that is not a requirement for travel, notwithstanding that there may be some differences about quarantine measures or other things if people are traveling with or without having been vaccinated. But the other reason that it's such an important issue is that it's pushing people to be vaccinated with more doses than they would otherwise be recommended to receive if the vaccines that they've already received that are WHO EUL'd are not recognized. And this, again, is not something that we should be doing in the face of constrained supply and inadequate supply at this point in countries where people are receiving and seeking out vaccines that they otherwise wouldn't need for the purpose of their own protection and their own vaccine status. So I think these are some of the reasons why this is such a critical issue. And again, calling on all countries to recognize the WHO EUL'd vaccines, which have met the criteria of efficacy, safety, and quality manufacturing.
Thank you so much for all those answers. The next question goes, we'll still stay in Latin America, goes to Bianca Rotier from Il Globo in Brazil.
Hi, Margaret. Can you hear me?
We can hear you very well, Bianca.
Thanks. Thanks a lot. Yeah, it's again on the topic of the negotiations at the World Trade Organization about the IP waiver. What do you expect from Brazil in this negotiation? In 2007, if I'm not wrong, with an anti-IV drug, Brazil was a key player. And now, what do you expect? Now Brazil should be doing more?
Thank you for the question. Dr. Aylward will begin.
Yeah, thank you so much, Bianca. As the Director General and the Secretary General reinforced in their opening comments or response to an earlier question, we're not looking to individual countries to do things. We're looking for countries collectively to work together to solve this problem. There are many countries that have got experience dealing with IP and waivers, compulsory licensing, et cetera, Brazil being just one of them. But what we expect of all countries is to bring that experience to the table, to find the collective solutions, to make sure as many companies with the capacities, the experience to be able to be making these vaccines have the opportunity to do it, and nothing is holding them back. Remember, if we look at the map today of vaccination around the world, we've got a big ring of green with a big splotch of red in the middle of it, and that splotch of red is in the areas of the world where there is no manufacturing capacity, where they, or there is manufacturing capacity, but they don't have access to the IP, to the technology, to the know-how to be able to make these vaccines. And I think, you know, 9 months ago, as the Director General emphasizes all the time, you know, there's a great promise that these vaccines would be rolled out equitably. That hasn't happened. And now we're at a point where we have got to look at how do we ensure every region is safe as we go forward, as these viruses evolve. And that's the reason WHO has been working so hard to put in place hubs, new mRNA and other vaccine production hubs in areas that are underserved to help solve this problem. But the more rapidly that they have access to the IP, to the technology, the know-how, the more quickly they will be able to help solve this problem. And that requires, to your point, Bianca, all countries working together in the WTO to make sure that IP is available. Those with experience, like ones you've mentioned, particularly important in this conversation.
And Dr. Mariangela will join, and then after that, Dr. Swaminathan.
Very quickly, just to say that there are other alternatives, also mechanisms that WHO has put in place, like the COVID Technology Access Pool with CTAP, and Brazil is one of the countries that supported this initiative that was led by Costa Rica, and it aims to pool together the voluntary licensing through a public mechanism like the Medicines Patent Pool, and also to provide a platform for sharing of technology, sharing of knowledge. So this is another way that we are also looking for the voluntary mechanisms, which also work under the patent system, the intellectual property system that's managed by the TRIPS Council at the WTO. Thank you.
Just to add on this topic, and as the Director General mentioned, and as Dr. Aylward mentioned as well, in addition to the process for the TRIPS waiver at the WTO, which we hope will be positive and successful, we've also put in place a mechanism for multilateral technology transfer hubs, the first one having been set up in South Africa. The concept here is that starting with mRNA technology, but the same concept would be applied to other technologies like viral vectors and subunit proteins, that the know-how is brought to this technology hub, is perfected there, there is manufacturing that starts happening, and at the same time, this place also serves as a training center for teams from other parts of the world to come and get trained on this technology and then to go back and set it up in their own countries. Now, PAHO, the regional office has taken a proactive role along with the countries of the region. And a few weeks ago, there was a seminar with all the member states of the PAHO region participating, where the first two mRNA production sites in Brazil and Argentina were launched. And this was done through a lot of regional consultations in a way that in the future would be sustainable, where there would be sharing of vaccine supplies across the region, where there would be also some countries that manufacture the raw materials while other countries are manufacturing the finished product, so that at no time there's an interdependence between countries, and at no time is there a situation in the future where the sort of vaccine nationalism that we've seen this time can impact vaccine supplies to all countries. So this requires technology to be shared, know-how to be shared, and as Dr. Simao just said, we have the mechanisms. We're working with the medicines patent pool in order for transfer of technology to be done in a transparent manner, but at the same time ensuring that there will be quality in that process, that the quality will be assured. And WHO will be launching a couple of other calls in the coming weeks. One will be for countries to express interest in receiving this mRNA technology. So now that the global hub has been set up in South Africa, we would like countries to apply to receive the technology. There will be a process of screening and some criteria for selection. We will also launch a call for countries to become training centers for manufacturing as a whole, because we know globally that there is a big shortage of workers that will be needed for these new factories to be set up. And so while training on specific technologies might occur at these hubs, there is a need also for training on all aspects of vaccine manufacturing. So we will keep you informed as those calls are developed and set out. But at the moment, what we need really is for the experts who know how to make these mRNA vaccines to work with us, to work with the hub, to make this as a success as quickly as possible.
Thank you. Thank you so much for all those answers. The next question goes to Margaret Bashir from Voice of America. Margaret, can you unmute yourself and ask your question?
Thank you so much. If you could just expand on the strategy a bit. I'm hearing a call to vaccinate 40% of the world by the end of this year, but I'm not really hearing exactly how you're going to do it. There's 12 weeks left in 2021. It seems a bit ambitious when you're saying 10% are vaccinated and 56 countries fell short of the 10% target. So can you just expand on that? And Dr. Tedros, would you make a call on rich countries to suspend booster shots until the end of the year, perhaps, in order to reach this 40% target? Thank you.
Thank you for those questions. Dr. Kate O'Brien, we'll start the answer.
Thank you so much for this question about the 40% target. I think we have to be really clear about what has already happened and what the target would actually mean. The first is on supply. I think it's clear from the analysis that we and others have been doing that there are enough doses that are being procured being manufactured on a monthly basis. We believe that there's approximately 1.5 billion doses of vaccines, largely EUL vaccines, WHO EUL vaccines, that are being manufactured on a weekly basis. And when we look at what it will take, first of all, for those 56 countries to get to 10%, that's 200 million doses just to get the lagging countries that have not had adequate access to that supply. That's a week's worth of the global supply of the WHO EUL vaccines. If that can't be achieved, I think that there really needs to be a fine point put on that. The next is looking at getting to the 40%. And there are also already a substantial number of countries that are well over the 40% target. This is not about whether the world is making enough vaccine that is adequate to achieve that 40% target. It's about whether those doses are going to the places that most need those doses in order to achieve the target. So this is really a problem of distribution of the doses. And that's why what we're calling for, and the DG has been very clear on this in the strategy, We're calling for actions now. We've heard the commitments. We've heard the talk. The DG has called for actions, and those are very clear in the strategy. Countries that have a substantial number of doses already and have achieved high vaccine coverage can swap their place in line for additional doses for the coming weeks and the coming months. The critical feature here is to get the doses to those places that are still lagging behind the target. The second part of this is that funding is needed for those countries to actually deliver the doses. We believe from the analysis that most of these doses have been contracted already and that there is a pathway forward on the supply side, but we also need to assure that the countries have the funding and the capacity within countries to deploy those doses. Understanding what that financial gap is really an analysis that we've provided in the strategy. We think it's around $8 billion on the delivery part of the supply, the delivery part of deploying those doses. So the actions that are needed right now in order to get to 40% is really about focusing the deployment of the supply to those countries that need those doses in order to match first the 10% target and then the 40% target.
Thank you, Dr. O'Brien. And Dr. Aylward will add.
Yeah, I wanted to take the second part of your question, Margaret, because that was the easy one about the Director General calling for a suspension on boosters. He did exactly that. It was, I believe, over 2 weeks ago, Director General, you looked at the situation with the 10% coverage in countries and said, look, every single dose makes a difference. We need to make sure every dose goes into some, right now is going into people who haven't received any doses, not additional doses going into those who already have. And, you know, we've had a lot of questions about that call for the suspension of boosters, and we believe it's had a very big impact. The speed at which countries are putting these policies in place, how carefully they're putting them in place, how they, the evidence they're looking at, who exactly they're targeting, and really just the highest risk people like the immunocompromised, these are really important decisions that are helping to affect the global supply. And Mark, just a comment on the first part about how ambitious this target is. It is, right? But if we look at the situation today, in North America, more than 40% of the population has two doses of vaccines. In South America, more than 40% of the population overall has two doses. In Asia, over 40% of the population overall. In the Western Pacific, they're getting very close to it. So most continents now are getting close to it. The problem is the gaps within, and of course, the problem in sub-Saharan Africa. And we have an emergency here. We've had the world locked down for 18 months. There's enough vaccine in the world. We have a distribution and delivery problem. And if we can't solve that problem in 12 weeks, that speaks poorly for the urgency we see in terms of ending the pandemic. Mike and I were talking about this just before the press conference, and Mike was highlighting, you know, if we get to 40%, we'll basically have ended the acute phase of the pandemic. That's how urgent this is. And the IMF comes out regularly talking to the billions of dollars we're losing every single month that we fail to meet those kind of targets. So it is ambitious, but it's very doable. The doses are already paid for. The issue is just getting them prioritized for COVAX, for AVAT, so they can get to the populations that are lagging behind and the countries that are lagging behind in this push.
Dr. O'Brien?
I just want to make one clarification also on this booster issue. The Strategic Advisory Group of Experts on Immunization has been meeting all this week, and one of the topics that has been addressed is about additional doses. And I want to make a really big distinction between doses that are considered booster doses, which is what the DG has called for a moratorium on, and doses that are required for a small subset of populations that don't respond adequately to the primary doses that everybody that are in the schedules for the vaccine. And I think we need to make a very clear distinction from those, as the DG has, that we're really talking about those doses that people would be receiving who have already received their primary doses, responded to those primary doses, you know, based on the evidence that we have. And we're not talking about immunocompromised people or for some vaccines in especially elderly populations, where an additional dose for that primary response, really to protect those high-risk people, may be needed. It's important that we not conflate those two issues. And SAGE will be addressing the booster dose issue in the coming weeks, which is a very broad and complex issue. And that moratorium is really clear that giving boosters for which there's very controversial evidence is absolutely not the priority, while so many people have not yet had even a primary series to protect them from the outset.
Thank you so much, all. We're really having excellent questions, but we are coming up to the hour. In fact, I think we're past the hour, so just time for one more question, and it will go to Donato Mancini from the Financial Times. Donato, please unmute yourself and ask your question.
Hi, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
We can now, but speak a little louder.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. So, is the U.S. helping out in a significant way with IP waivers, given the support it signaled earlier this year? And I'm just hoping to get a bit more detail here. Are there any governments or companies specifically that are not doing enough to achieve vaccine equity? Thank you.
Donato, I don't think we would call out specific companies, but we could offer a general answer. I'm looking around.
Well, I can take the second part of the question, sure, about are any governments not doing enough to achieve vaccine equity? There's every country that is over 40% coverage today. If they are not prioritizing the lower income, unvaccinated parts of the world, COVAX, AVAT, they're simply not doing enough to help achieve global equity. So I think there's, you know, Donato, a huge number of countries that could be doing more to try and help achieve vaccine equity. As Kate highlighted just now, we need the countries that have achieved high levels of coverage to allow the manufacturers to ensure that they prioritize the contracts that COVAX have. We need the countries that have contracted huge numbers of doses beyond what they will use for their own populations to not only donate doses, but more importantly, at this point, that's a stopgap measure, to swap their place in the queue so that COVAX, AVAT, and are serviced, and to remove any excuses any manufacturers or others might have for not servicing the key instruments that are in place to achieve global equity in the rollout of vaccines. And the only truly global mechanism in that regard is COVAX. So that mechanism can assure any doses that come in are prioritized to the places that are lagging the most. And so that's what we need prioritized. Every government that has contracted large numbers of doses beyond what they need and are still receiving those doses, any countries that have achieved high levels of coverage now, all of them need to be part of the solution, working with manufacturers to say, prioritize COVAX, because we need the world vaccinated. We need it vaccinated fast.
And Dr. Mariangela Schimmel will add.
And just to add to what Bruce said, Donato, because we also, you know, that we are doing the allocation rounds, and we do urge the companies to come in and do the prioritize the delivery to the COVAX contracts. But let me say that we are, through the mechanisms we have, we are trying to push the agenda of equity, and we did an allocation round now in October exclusively for countries who were less than 10%, and we are now working on allocation 8 and 9, also prioritizing the countries that are being left behind in this vaccine delivery and vaccine equity. So there are mechanisms that we are using to address the inequality and the inequity in access, but we also need the companies to prioritize the COVAX contracts. Thank you.
Dr. O'Brien, and then
I think one of the other things to build on what Mariangela just said and what Bruce has identified that we've been calling for quite some time is that COVAX is completely transparent, as is AVAT, about where doses are going. We are really asking for that kind of transparency from all other parties. it's nearly impossible to know and hold accountable the commitments that manufacturers have made and countries that already have a large number of doses are making unless we all together understand where these 1.5 billion doses a month are actually going. And there are it's fantastic if and when manufacturers are prioritizing COVAX and AVAT, but it's a little bit difficult to square the commitments that are being made with what's actually happening and where the doses are flowing or not flowing. So we're really also calling for this transparency around the doses, where they're being deployed to, how many are being manufactured on a monthly basis, and that's how collectively we can all make adjustments that are needed to actually achieve the targets. And the targets are, you know, this issue of equity, it's not for equity's sake, although that is frankly a sufficient reason to pursue equity. But it's really about what it's going to take to shut down this virus. And vaccines cannot do this alone. It's not about vaccines being, you know, the magic wand that's going to stop this. But we're not going to get there unless we actually have vaccines being deployed as a significant part of the solution to getting population immunity. And if we don't do that on a worldwide basis in a relatively equal step, we're going to continue to have a prolongation of this pandemic. That's the reason this should be done fundamentally, first and foremost, is we all want this pandemic to be over.
Thank you very much, Dr. O'Brien, and I think we all agree with what you just said. We want it over. I will now close this press conference. I know there were many, many more of you online. I thank you very much for your excellent questions, and please send them to Media Inquiries. We will help you provide the answers. And now I'll hand it over to Dr. Tedros for his final remarks and to close.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much to all who have joined today to our media, and also thank you to Secretary General for joining us, and look forward to seeing you in our upcoming press conference next week. Thank you. All the best.